That's right. We're right here at Sharp Fast's gallery this afternoon. I have a real treat for you. I have Dr. Joe Patton. He is the executive, chief executive officer over there at Gleams. He's a saxophone player. He's been in Washington, D.C. He's traveled around. He's been involved in a lot of things in his life, and now he's here in Greenwood. As I said, he is the chief executive officer for Gleams Human Resources. He's got a lot going on, and he agreed to sit down and talk to us today. How you doing, Dr. Joe?
I'm doing well, Ellen. Thanks for asking, and thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Well, we are looking forward to talking about a lot of different things, but, of course, one of the things that is going on, this is Black History Month, and, of course, one of the great things that we have right here in Greenwood is the Maze facility, the Maze House, right over there at Gleams. How has that been received? How have people been coming through?
You know, it has actually surprised me. We have a number of visitors that come through. We've had a number of young people, a number of schools have brought their classrooms through. This past Sunday, a group from New York, the New York Omegas, brought 60 young people down to visit the Maze House and the museum and to listen to a two-hour lecture from our curator, Lori Sarton. It's been a success all the way. The community has supported it. The city council, county council have gotten behind us. The Self Foundation has been there. Our staff has pulled in behind us and given us all of the necessary support. And we're real pleased to have that. That's sort of a national venue. As soon as we can market this thing nationally, I think the visitations will increase. But we're happy.
Absolutely. Now, what, for those that don't know, in just a synopsis, Dr. Maze, he came from very humble beginnings.
That's correct.
He ended up as the head of Morehouse College.
27 years.
And he actually counseled Martin Luther King.
Absolutely. You know, without a doubt, I can say I met Dr. Maze when I was probably around 12 or 13 years old.
How about that?
He came up to do the dedication for Maze High School in Paclet, South Carolina, and my parents were educators there. And Dr. Maze had dinner with my parents in the same venue. And he was an amazing man. In stature, he was above 6 feet. One of the things that I really like about Maze was his ability to relate to young people.
At an older age.
Exactly.
Now, that's tough.
He could do that. As a matter of fact, when Dr. King went to Morehouse, on Tuesdays, Dr. Maze used to do a sermon Tuesday morning. You know, all of us that went to HBCUs or historically black colleges and universities, a lot of them were parochial schools or church affiliated. And chapel and vespers and those things were a must. You got credit hours for attending those things, just like you did any other course. Well, Maze, you had to attend the Tuesday morning sermon for President Maze. And Dr. King, being a student and a freshman, would say to Dr. Maze, I need to ask you some questions right after you finish with your sermon. And Dr. Maze would say, go to my office, young man, and wait. And I'll be over there shortly, and we can spend some time. And they would go over there, and King was full of questions. King went to Morehouse College with all intentions of becoming a lawyer, going into a pre-law track, and coming out going to law school. After having been counseled by Dr. Maze, King was talked into going into theology. Maze talked him into leaving the law the way it was, going into theology. So as far as I'm concerned, without Dr. Maze, there would have never been a Martin Luther King as we know him today.
Why do you think he did that? Why?
Well, I think he did it because, first of all, if you look at Maze's history, Maze was an excellent speaker. Mm-hmm. His oratory was out of this world. His thought pattern was exemplary. It was out there. And he had gone in to school up in New England and competed with the brightest of the bright.
Where did he go to school? Was it Bowdoin?
He started in South Carolina.
Right.
State College in high school. Then he left there and went up to Lewiston, Maine.
Bowdoin, yes. That's right up there where I'm from.
Right.
Yes, exactly.
And he became the captain. Well, his thing was he had been told that blacks were inferior to whites when it came to mental capacity and academic abilities. So he didn't want to go up to Bates or Bowdoin. He didn't want to go up.
Maybe it was
it
Bates.
It was Bates.
It was Bates.
He didn't
want
to go to Bates College to prove to the world that he was equal to his white counterpart. He was wanting to prove to himself that he could study anything anybody else could.
And he could stand the cold.
And that was the even worse part. And of course, he also said at one time, when he was up there, he became the captain of their football team, the captain of their debate team, and graduated from there as Phi Beta Kappa.
And that was totally unusual for a black man from the South to end up in Maine.
He was one of three, they said,
that
was at Bates College.
Yeah.
And of course, when we had the open house, the president of Bates College came down. And she also told us that they have, to this day, they have a group of academic gentlemen there called the Mays Men.
The Mays Men?
Mays Men. They're named after Mays and his success. Well, he wanted King to, because he just knew that King, besides too, he and King shared another interest, nonviolence and Mahatma Gandhi. The Gandhian philosophy of nonviolence.
Right. Okay.
And then Mays also in his book was called Born to Rebel. He didn't do that by getting a gun or, shouting obscenities out to folks about what's going on in the world. He did it by spiritually relating what's happening to what needs to be happening and intellectually conversing with people to convince them that what's going on, as far as he was concerned, was not right. It was not the right thing to do. And he saw something in Martin King that could help him take that movement. They even called Dr. Mays, and the latest book that someone wrote about him was called The Schoolmaster of the Movement. Because he basically was the underpinning of that community, of that movement. And of course, he was such an intellectual and surrounded himself. Here's a man who walked with the Pope, who sat down with three presidents, who traveled to India in 1936 on the Queen Mary to meet Mahatma Gandhi. 1936, a lot of minorities in this state didn't even have a car.
Right.
Much less on the Queen Mary going to India.
So what do you think today Martin Luther King and Dr. Mays would be saying about the violence and the things that are happening in our world today?
You know, I'm almost about to say that, as with me, they're speechless. Because this is not what we had or what they had in mind. And neither me, I came along during the civil rights days and fighting for equality didn't have anything to do with what I see that's happening today. It just meant to me that I just want you to give me a seat at the table, I do the rest. I had no idea, even the violent part of that movement. You know, my parents and those folks that were considered themselves cadre to my generation discouraged violence and thievery and all and this indiscretion and morals. You and I had a conversation earlier about morals. There were certain things that you were just taught and they were innate and that you grew up with them and you respected. I got on the elevator, incidentally, Alan. I was in, last week, I was down in Orlando at a meeting and I got on the elevator about 4 o'clock in the afternoon and there were four ladies there, retirees. And as soon as I and they were not of African American descent. And as soon as I stepped on the elevator, I said to the ladies, "Good afternoon, ladies." And I removed my headpiece. Well, when I grew up, my father taught us that when you get on the elevator with ladies, you take your hat off.
Or how about when you sit in a restaurant?
Oh, you'd never eat a meal with a hat on. Never.
Okay. And how often do we see that today?
I saw it yesterday. I was in a restaurant.
Yep.
You never do that. And you always stand back and let the ladies offer the elevator first. Or you open the door for a lady. You know, I mean, just certain things you just do.
Just a little bit of respect.
And you say yes, sir, and no, sir, to your elders. You know, yes, ma'am, and no, ma'am.
Right.
And you dare let them see you doing anything that would not, that would be a glitch in your character.
Absolutely. Yeah. Hey, I'm here with Dr. Pat, and we're going to continue this conversation in just a moment, but let's hear a quick word from our sponsors. Don't you go away.
Gold, more precious than any other time in history. Do you have gold? Do you need cash? Then bring it to SFG. That's Sharp Facets Gallery, 1220 Bypass 72, Greenwood. Telephone 229-6613. Don't forget, we buy diamonds too. Paying the highest prices for your gold and diamonds at Sharp Facets Gallery.
Oh, that's right. We're right back here, Sharp Facets Gallery. I am thoroughly enjoying my conversation here with Dr. Joe Patton. He, of course, is the executive, chief executive officer for Gleams and Human Resources here in our area. Covers a large area, and I'm very fortunate to have him sitting down here with us today. You know, we were just talking about Dr. Mays and Martin Luther King. What do you think Dr. Mays would be thinking about the way things are today in our world?
Well, I even hate to think about
it. You hate to think about it. I hate to think about it sometimes.
He was a very formal man. Mm-hmm. And when I say formal, he believed that everything has its place. He used to call play frivolity. And he said even frivolity has its place, he would say. But for the most part, that is an order. He used to say, in one of his books where I read, that he said that God is not the author of confusion, that there is a divine order to nature which should transcend onto humans. Therefore, we need to pay attention to that divine order. Now, if Dr. Mays were to come up out of the ground today and see these kids walking by her with their pants down below their gluteus maximum, and their underwear showing, the top of their jeans, walking slowful and barely shifting their feet around, because he walked upright and with a gait. Mm-hmm. He would probably die again, go right back in the ground, for the simple reason that all of the work, that he, all of his life's work, put into educating young Negro males at Morehouse College for 27 years has turned out to be this. I mean, even at Morehouse, I've been on the campus, there is a bit of this you see
at Morehouse College.
And the president is really upset about it. But it's not a whole lot you can do about it, because you can't put somebody like me with each one of those students all the time, 24/7.
Sure.
So when they leave the gate, then they back in the hood, and they go back into doing what everybody else is doing.
You know, that I think that's very interesting, you know, particularly when we think about the fact that Dr. Mays came from very, very, very humble beginnings.
Yeah.
How somebody that could come from, I mean, where did he come from? It was
Epworth,
and a very small home house.
3-bedroom house with 11 people living in it.
I mean,
not 3-bedroom, 3-room.
So how does somebody come and become that in the world?
Well, you know, it's almost a mystery. It's strange how, and this is gonna sound like a little heresy here or something. I don't know what you want to call it, but it's real strange how people can come from little small communities and towns like Plains, Georgia, and wind up president of the United States.
There you go.
Like Benny Mays from Epworth in Greenwood County, wind up as chairman of the school board in Atlanta for 12 years, and wind up as an advisor to three presidents, you know. And then there's a gentleman that came from a little town like Bethlehem. I mean, you know, you really want to get on out there.
Sure.
A bit. But these small towns and these communities seem to spawn a desire to move up from that which they coming and to make something of themselves. Dr. Mays once told me personally that anybody can be nobody, boy. That was his word, but everybody can be somebody. And I remember that.
Well, that is a very good one. Now, you know, but we were talking earlier about people, that part of the problem you felt was that everybody is striving to be.
Exactly.
So how does that relate to Dr. Mays and his ability to become someone?
Okay, he wanted to become someone, but he was not a materialistic man. He didn't care. You know, nowadays everybody's got to have a designer piece in their closet, several pieces. Mm-hmm. Everybody's got to have a Mercedes or a Lexus. And I'm not doing that to, nobody's paying me either way to say that. But I'm just telling you, I'm making an observation.
Right.
And at the same time, you know, Mays, his secretary told me, Miss Sally Warner, who worked for him, and really admired him, you know. You find a woman that's married to a man and admires him, a woman that works with him day in and day out and admires him, then pretty much he's genuine.
Right.
She told me that Mays was not a materialistic person. She said she used to have to make him buy a suit. He had suits that he'd recycle.
Right.
And they'd slick from ironing them with an iron. And she used to take him to a store, I won't name the store down in Atlanta, and she picked out three suits and was writing the check for him. And Dr. Mays said, I came in here to get one suit just for this speech I got to make tomorrow. And he said, I know, Sally told you to put two more in there, you know. And, you know, he just was not a materialistic man. When he died, he had some wealth because he hadn't spent any of the, you know, over the years when he got an honorarium. So Dr. Mays had 56 honorary degrees.
Wow.
From colleges all over the world. And he had gotten gifts from Indian kings and princesses and prince and stuff. And he had some money, but he used it in helping to educate. He and that story about Margaret Mitchell.
Mm-hmm.
Margaret Mitchell threw Mays and 40 African-American men to Meharry Medical College to become doctors. And the two of them paid for it.
Wow.
You know? So, you know, we are on Striver's Row now. And everybody wants to have the material kinds of things. But Dr. Mays' house, if it had 2,000 square feet in it, I wouldn't know it. I'd been in it, you know, in Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just an ordinary, it's a nice brick home, mm-hmm, with a basement. But he didn't need that. I don't think he ever owned a car, an automobile. But, you know, he had one available to him.
Sure.
And he probably didn't need to own one. But now we have to own these things. We've got to go. We talk about people going that got stranded on that cruise ship. You know, we got people, now it's in vogue to take a cruise.
Sure.
The past 10, 15 years. Before then, if we could itch out a 3-4 day vacation, we did well.
That's true.
Now we'll come up with $7,000-$8,000 and get on a cruise ship and spend 7 days. So things have just changed. They've changed, and to the point that it scares me, because I've got 4 boys and a girl. And I'm constantly watching them, because they grew up with having what they needed.
Sure.
And some.
Right.
But on the other hand, I tried to let them understand that me providing this for you is a whole lot different than you trying to provide it for yourself.
Absolutely.
And you can't provide what I provide for you if you're going to flip hamburgers.
That's true.
That ain't going to work.
And that's why you need the education.
Exactly. And education comes in several forms. College is not for everybody.
Sure.
You know, and I've got one son, I took him to college. He beat me back home.
Now, that's pretty impressive.
He was back there when I got back on the porch. Because I went somewhere else before I got back home.
But, okay.
But he was home, you know, and he does well. He's a man. He has two sons. He's been married for 22 years. He takes care of his, and he hadn't asked me for a nickel, I don't guess, in 15 or 20 years. Not anything.
Sure.
So he's taking care of himself. But then I got three others. One went to West Point. I got another one that finished Carolina in the law school. And, you know, I got a daughter that's a nurse attorney. You know, they went on, but they wanted to go to college and do something different. This one fella, he's the oldest, too. He didn't want anything to do with any college. And he told me straight up. But you got to know your children. You got to watch where they are. At night, I used to go in the neighborhood, and the boys used to tease my sons, here come your daddy. You know, because I'd be looking for them. I'd round them up and take them home.
Right.
Because I didn't want them hanging out under the streetlight.
And that is the difference between a lot of what's going on today and what went on then. Hey, I'm Ann Eller right here with you this afternoon. We're going to join South Carolina News in Progress. We'll be back. If you've got a question for Dr. Joe, give us a call, 229-7984. That's 229-7984. We'll be right back.
This is Philip Biffle, your Greenwood Edward Jones Financial Advisor. Do you have a recovery plan for your investments? If not, there are several reasons we think you should. While interest rates are very low, certain income strategies and investments could help increase your investment income. Also, many investment portfolios are out of balance at a time when proper investment diversification may be most critical. You also may want to review your portfolio to consider replacing lower quality investments with higher quality investments that may be at attractive prices. No one can control what the market will do next. You can, however, take advantage of investment opportunities that exist today. At the same time, it is important to be well positioned for whatever the market does tomorrow. Please call me, Philip Biffle, or stop by my office today to develop your personalized recovery plan investment strategy. Please call me, Philip Biffle, at 229-0444, or stop by my office today to develop your personalized recovery plan investment strategy. Edward Jones, Making Sense of Investing, member SIPC.
We're right back here at Sharp Facets Gallery. Well, we've been having conversation the whole time. We're going to try to run back through some of it, but we just had a call from Shanisa McCord. She wants to know if you're writing a book. If you don't, a lot of info will be lost to other generations. Well, how about that? Are you writing a book?
Nope, I'm not. But I've been told several times that I should write a book. And my wife has talked to me a lot. I think I might even try it now that technology...
That you can talk it and the book will write itself.
Right, exactly.
If you had to sit there and write it out, it might be laborious.
Yeah, I think I might try it now. I do have some experiences that I'd like to share, but one of my visions, or one of my passions, should I say, is to influence young people that they can make it in this world the right way. You can make it. And when I say the right way, I don't mean my way. I mean society has established a norm for being successful, whether we like it or not. It's been said. We know what we... Ann and I were just talking about two kids, a garage, a house with a picket fence, and a dog. You know, I mean, those are the things that say you have arrived in America. You got a piece of the American dream.
Exactly.
Well, in order to, you can't get that stealing. You can't get it being trifling and not working.
Or being in drugs.
Being on drugs. You can't get it drawing a welfare check. You know, you can't get that looking with a handout from somewhere.
But why is our society becoming that way, Dr. Joe?
It's becoming that way because the people that our young people are around live from check to check, because the government has so many different ways to, and rather than helping people, we're enabling folks at a certain point in time. I believe in help. I'm in the help people business.
Absolutely. Gleams, absolutely.
You know, yeah, I'd be the last one to say not to help somebody. But you have to understand that even my children, they knew that they couldn't lie to me. I told my son, I got one time to pay a lawyer for you.
One time. We're not going to keep doing this.
Then I'll pay the lawyer because I love you. That's the only reason. Whether you're right or wrong. I got one time to pay a bail bondman to buy something back for you that was your inalienable right when you was born. with your freedom. If you mess around and let somebody take it, I'm not going to pay to get it back for you.
But so, what has happened to the family fiber that we don't see that anymore? We are losing that. We are seeing kids raised just not with the moral fiber that you and I and so many others were imbued with.
Because people are so involved now in that striving situation. Everybody's striving not to take care of themselves. Anyway, they brought the children here. And the children are fending for themselves. They cut them loose when they get up to about the fourth, fifth grade. You see, if kids come home from school to an empty nest, the parents are both working. They open the front door, throw their books in, reach up in the refrigerator and get some bologna, put it between two pieces of bread, bite on it a couple of times, and head out the door to play. They forgot all about. There's nobody there to see that they do their homework. You know, say that they take off their school clothes like we used to have to do. You know, nobody there to even look up the block and see who the heck they're playing with.
Yeah.
You know, that means a lot. And so we become so, and the parents are working now because they're trying to get ahead, but it ain't for the children. It's for the wrong reasons.
What is it for? For themselves?
For themselves.
They need to be able to take that cruise.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
And identify with the house. You know, and that's a major thing. I mean, these people are, including me, I came along, from time to time I have to check myself. Because I want something just because it's a symbol of success that I saw on somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And I figure I owe myself that because I'm just as successful as they are.
And you work hard.
And I do.
Work hard, so you should be able to have it.
But my success is in my children. And my children, I have never, look, I have never had to bail a son of mine out of trouble. Now, I know I'm blessed.
Mm-hmm.
And I probably should have bailed them all several times, but I didn't know nothing about it. You know?
They didn't want you to know about
exactly.
it. And isn't that the difference? They didn't want you to know that
exactly.
about it. Yes.
And then the neighbors kept them in check, too. The whole thing about it takes a village.
Yeah.
It does take a village. You got to call me. And tell me that you saw my son over here at Burger King in a hoodie at 2 o'clock in the morning.
But I don't want to get involved. I don't want to get involved.
That's the problem.
Exactly.
That's the problem. And I'm telling you, we have a society that we've got to turn it around. You look at the president.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of Obamas in the world today, in the United States. He just happened to have been the chosen one. He was in the right place at the right time. But I know some guys that are just as smart or smarter.
Mm-hmm.
I know some guys that have come from situations much more difficult than his, you know. And they are citizens that are respected in the community.
Mm-hmm.
Their children are doing well, just like the president's children.
Sure.
They've created an environment for success. There's a certain amount, in my house when I grew up, there's a certain amount of time in my house. My grandmother was an English teacher, and she had one of those old blackboards that sit on like an A-frame thing.
Right.
And she'd get up, and right after we finished dinner at night, she'd get up there and she'd diagram sentences to my sister and I used to hate it.
Sure, of course.
She'd be taking us through things that we know, diphthongs and digraphs and all that. And, you know, we say...
Well, what do you need to talk correctly for anyways, right?
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. And I still have a tendency today to slip on the other side if I'm not careful, because that's what I'm around every day. Your environment once becomes a part of you.
Your environment does become part of you, right.
It becomes a part of you. And I will slip on the other side. And my mother used to say to me, Joe, that's not the dope. That's the door. And the floor. That's the floor. And I'd hate for her to correct me. And she'd do it in front of my friends who would come over to play.
Right.
And then when I would go to take, I'd be going, I know you're going to love this one.
Okay.
The guys out on the street would be playing football in the vacant lot.
Right.
I'd be going down the street to what they call the USO at the time, which was a recreation center.
Sure.
I'd be going to USO and I have my tap shoes on hanging over my shoulder, my ballet shoes on the other.
Oh, come on, Joe. Okay.
My mother said that's part of a cultural experience that you need to have. I'd be going to my piano lessons, you know, and the guys in the theater, you know, I used to hate the pass because they make fun of me. And you know what?
That was called bullying, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was bullying.
And at the same time, though, I'm thinking, you know, I used to just hate this. My mother, she wouldn't even let me wear long pants until I got to the sixth grade. I had to wear short pants and knickers. You remember
knickers? Oh, yeah. From skiing, I know knickers. Yeah,
right.
Absolutely.
But she would say that you act too mannish when you put on long pants. You need to grow up first. And when you become a man, then you can
graduate to the long pants.
Right.
What do you think about our kids today? Well, there's a couple of things. You know, we have little kids wearing high heels.
Mm-hmm.
Little girls wearing heels. We've got kids wearing makeup and all this kind of stuff. I mean, we're not allowing them to be kids. Or the other side, I'm often told, is, well, they learn different. They're so much more advanced. They don't need to be kids the way we used to think of kids as kids. What do you think, Dr.
Joe? That's not true. My undergraduate education was elementary education.
And was it really?
Yeah. And because my mother was an elementary college professor. She taught in the education department. And all children need to be children.
I'm glad to hear you say that.
All children need to. That's part. If you go into human growth and development or some of those other theory books that they use in education, you understand that that's part of the four life cycles, that childhood piece.
Right.
And it's like when you start building a house, if you don't put the foundation in like it ought to be, then when you get to the second floor,
it's all going to fall in.
You got problems.
Right.
So growing up has to experience childhood. You have to be a child. And I don't care how much advanced the child comes here. I mean, even Einstein used to play. You know, I mean, children need to play. They need to grow. They need to be experienced. Little children, they need to experience success. They need to experience failure.
I think that's a big one, too, today for kids. We don't want our kids to have any failures, but they need to have some failures.
You gotta have failure.
Right.
I mean, out of failure, a lot of times comes a second chance to do something. I guess somebody said that before.
But, well, I'd rather have a child fail a test or fail a grade or something at an early age where it's not going to affect their whole life than to grow up and then experience failure and not be able to deal with it.
Exactly. And see, failure is something that most people that fail at something either avoid it in the future.
Right.
Or they learn how to capture that and make that, turn it into a success. I mean, it breeds success in some cases. But being a child, you need to do that as a little child. I just hate to think that I was 25 or 30 years old before I failed at something.
Now I need to ask you, the ballet shoes and the tap shoes over your shoulder and learning to play the piano and everything, you look back at that, was that a bad experience?
Well, it wasn't. It wasn't. I hated it the whole time.
The whole time.
I mean, here I am and now standing up on, you know, doing ballet, trying to dance on my toes and, you know.
Were you a skinny guy?
Yeah, I was little.
Because you're not today, Joe.
No, because now, one of the things my wife and I was talking about not too long ago.
Stay over on the mic. There you go.
One of the things that my wife and I was talking about the other day is that when people look at me after they hear me talk like this, and she says a lot of times they don't look at you like you are the person that you are, the rotunda and the whole bit, you know. And so she said, I said, well, I never expected to be like this in my life either, darling. And she said, well, if it makes you feel any worse or better, I never expected you to look like that either.
It's amazing how life goes on, isn't it?
Yeah, life goes on, but I'm telling you, you just want that. That taught me a couple of things. One was I had to do what my parents wanted me to do. They set the course, and I had to fall in line.
But parents set the course.
Yeah, they
set. Do they do that today?
No. No, I hope my grandchildren are getting some benefit of that because their parents, I set the course for their parents. And I hope that they're doing it. I can't be with them. I can only look at the results when they bring the grandchildren around.
Sure.
But I got one grandchild that I know I need to be around him a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
Because when he comes to me, he's just not where I think he ought to be. But children, you got to, having children, let me tell you something, children are yours till you die, they die. It's simple.
Sure.
And even my, like, you just asked me a question about my son who's involved in some, the one that's the bodyguard and he does all of that. He pumps iron, skydives, rock climbs, scuba dives, rides a Harley.
Bodyguard to the stars.
Yeah, bodyguard to the stars. He does all kinds of stuff. And I'm scared. A lot of times when the phone rang, I said, Lord, I hope there's nothing wrong with this boy, you know. But you know what? When I raised him to take care of himself. I'm real careful about him, but I know him. He's 44 years old. I worry about him now. Every night when I go to bed, I think about him a little bit, you know, and hope that he, whatever he's doing, he'll be safe through the night. And so you have to, once you have those children, it's more to it than just going to the nursery and tapping on the glass and saying, that's mine right over there. It's a whole lot more to it than that.
There is.
And if we could teach that today, we'd have a whole lot less trouble.
But how can, but what is the future, Dr. Joe? What is the future? I mean, you see it, yeah. You've experienced it, you work with it actually every day, every there day. With gleams and everything.
Sure.
What is the future?
Well, I'm thinking that the future is, and this, again, this is my opinion. I'm thinking that at one point in time, I see some of it now, we are going to, society is going to dictate. First of all, our prisons are full to capacity.
Mm-hmm.
They're killing our kids like you wouldn't believe. I mean, the bigger cities where they got these projects and stuff, they're shooting the kids and putting them in wheelchairs by the dozens.
Well, you just, no parent should have to experience that.
No parent.
And
no
we're
parent.
Seeing a lot of it, yes.
And no parent should have to bury his child.
Yes.
Especially if it's an untimely death.
Right.
I think that the schools now, we're going to, some kind of way, that the community is going to get involved with the school administration to the point that we can educate some parents, too. Parents need to be taught parenting, need to be exposed to the successes of good parenting. It's hard for you. It's like I had a child tell his mother the other day over in my building. She was correcting him from something that he was doing in the hallway. And she said, well, I'm your mother. I'm supposed to. And he said, well, now, I was with my daddy for 15 years. So how do you know what the... You don't know anything about parenting. My daddy raised me. He said that in the hallway. Now, see, if that had been my mother, I said that too. I'd got up off the floor.
Right. That's what I was going to say. She would have walloped you.
She would not have taken... She would not let you talk back to her. And so now we have to have people that get involved in the schools so that we... And one thing I like about Head Start, by the way,
mm-hmm.
which is one of my projects.
Yes.
Head Start has a holistic approach, not just looking at the cognitive growth and the health and the social needs of the child. We've gotten now into the literacy piece. If a child's going to be with me from 8 o'clock in the morning to 2:30 in the afternoon, we ought to teach them some reading, writing, and arithmetic, as they say. Mm-hmm. And the other part of that is that if you're going to have the child in an environment, then the parent must understand what's a wholesome environment. And the parent needs to be coached and trained and persuade and help to go to school and better themselves in order to, and that's the only way it's going to work.
Because how is that working with Head Start?
With Head Start, it works. I can't say that it's 100%, but we do keep up with the successes.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you, I just had a gentleman come in to do an audit of a young man that went through Head Start, came back to do an audit. Now, I was shocked. He sat down and talked with me. He's a Head Start kid. And now he's an auditor with the federal government, auditing the program this way he got his start. He was singing high praises for Head Start. He's an MBA, CPA, PhD.
Wow.
In the world of finance. And I think that's great.
That is great.
So, and my Head Start director, Elaine, she's gotten 3 different degrees while she's there, and she's a Head Start child also. So I think all of that's good.
I think that is good. But what do you think about how are we going to be able to get our parents on board? I mean, we mentioned this a little earlier in the show, Society of Give Me, Taking, mm-hmm. and this type of thing. How do we change that culture and get, well, let's just say it, raise up all our people? Ooh, that's a tall order, Ann.
Yeah, that is tall. The only thing that I can say is that we as citizens take our responsibility as citizens very seriously. Get involved. Get involved in the church. Get involved with your city, county, local, state government. Exercise your right to vote. Make sure that we get people in office who feel the same way we feel about this society. People in office who seemingly to us, we make mistakes, of course, have the same moral fiber that we have. You know.
I think we need to regain some of our moral fiber.
Oh, yes.
I think we're missing that, whether it's in the schools, in the family, even in the churches from some aspects. We're not pulling that all together and giving our kids a straight vision.
No.
They have too many, they can't go straight because there's too many turns.
Turns, and then you got the kids that have like you say turn, but they have an alternative.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. If you got an alternative, you know, it used to be that when we were taking final exams, your exam, Mr. Patton, would be tomorrow morning at 8:15 to 10:30.
Yep.
If you miss that exam, you flunk. It's simple.
That's it. No second chance.
Mm. Now. You wait till you see Professor Sunza walking across the campus. You go over there and talk to him. And before
he gives you another chance to take that test.
He gives you a makeup.
Yeah.
You come to my office and I give you a makeup. No, that ain't the way the game's played. Not out here in America when you start working.
Absolutely. Yeah. You are so right. We had a call from Missy Clarkson. It says, Ann, you and Dr. Patton should have an opinion program every week. Very enjoyable. And she is a pragmatist. How about that? That's
all
pretty
right.
Neat. Yeah, that's pretty neat.
Yeah, I appreciate the comments.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we've been talking. We were going to talk a little bit about Black history. I think somehow we have talked about Black history.
Yeah.
Because we've talked about our culture today. And after all, culture is what makes the world go around, doesn't it?
It certainly does.
So in closing, what would you like to talk about here? We've got 3 or 4 minutes. What would you like to talk about?
I guess one of the things that I'd like to mention would be, you know, there's a real story around being successful.
There is.
But there is a titillating story.
Uh-huh. Okay.
About failing to be successful. And I think the media, present company excluded.
Thank you.
The media has, you know, that sensational stuff sells bites.
Yep.
It sells script, you know. And I think we in this country have become obsessed
with the media. You know, I say that it's great that we have the internet.
Yeah.
But it's also been a detriment to have the internet from the standpoint of the informational highway that we have going here. What happens in one part of the country, now we're doing in another part of the country.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And of course, information is power, but then a pistol also has power too.
Yes.
And it depends on what direction it's pointed in and who's using it as to what that power can do.
Sure.
You know, if there's a large animal coming at you from like a tiger or a lion and you shoot it to save your life, that's one thing.
Exactly.
But then if you step outside of this office here and start shooting up the street, that's another. Same power. So power has to be channeled. And it's us. We still are our brother's keeper. And that's something that we've forgotten, too. We've gotten so caught up into what we like and who we like. You know, just because a person is of a different hue or came from a different set of beginnings, then we don't want to socialize with that person. And a lot of it has nothing to do with any first-hand information you have.
It's all the secondary stuff.
Exactly, because most
people... It's called gossip, right?
Exactly.
Yep. This is WCRS right here in Greenwood. Go ahead, finish your thought.
And my thought is, if we could dismiss some of this, which a lot of it has happened over the years, but we got a long way to go. If we could dismiss some of that and look at each other as this is my neighbor, I'm responsible for your well-being as well as you are responsible for mine. We are to share, although you may be a little bit more fortunate than I, you know, I am happy that you are who you are and where you are. And I'm happy that we are who we are and where we are. And I think if we can do those kinds of things and work with folks that we... I don't mean to run out in the street and try to be some kind of evangelist and stuff and pray people, ask folks to do certain things in order to be saved or in order to be right. I just mean be yourself and respect your neighbor, care for your neighbor. We are our brother's keeper. And inasmuch as the Bible says, inasmuch as we do the least of these, our children... Look at the children and make sure that they have half a chance.
Absolutely.
And it's up to us to give them that opportunity.
It's up to us to watch out for these kids, and it's for us not to turn our face away and say, oh, well, I didn't see that happen.
It's hard for me to believe that a boy can get up my home, take 4 automatic weapons and 600-700 rounds of ammunition and leave home and go to school and shoot up a school. And the mother and father at home had no other idea
this happened.
He could do that.
Yes, I agree.
I mean, it's your child. He lives in your house, and they had all that ammunition and them weapons in your house.
Then why weren't they locked up so that the child couldn't get to them? That is the question. If you're going to have those things, make sure they're under lock and key.
Exactly.
Well, Dr. Joe, it is always a pleasure to sit down and talk with you. I thoroughly have enjoyed this conversation, and I know a lot of our listeners have this afternoon. Thanks so much for coming out today.
Thank you so much for having me, and this is one of my favorite places, you know.
Sharp Facets.
Sharp Facets, yeah. I do come to Sharp Facets a lot, and it just happened that I like bling.
Yeah.
So every now and then I find a piece or two in here I'll purchase. But on top of that, Ann and Jeff have become good friends of mine.
Absolutely.
And anytime that you call Ann, I'll be here. And I hope we can move into some other areas, too, so we won't wear out the public with redundancy.
Absolutely.
When you come up with another topic, call me and give me a moment or two to gather some thoughts and do a little bit of research, and we'll do this again real soon.
That sounds great. Thank you so much, Dr. Joe Patton. This is WCRS right here in Greenwood. Bye-bye, everybody.